You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Carl Hiaasen has written many funny novels, although they're usually about serious subjects: environmental destruction, political failure, telemarketers run amok. Celebrity culture gets the Hiaasen treatment in his latest novel, Star Island. It's about a Pop-Tart whose professional name is Cherry Pie, trying to make a comeback at age 22. The money from her previous albums is running out, and after too many boozy drug flings, a body double is kept on retainer to make public appearances. Add to that some relentless paparazzi, ex-cons, a crazy ex-governor, some brilliant Florida sun. It's published by Knopf, and I'm very pleased that it brings Carl Hiaasen, the Ernie Pyle Lifetime Achievement Award-winning columnist, back to our show. Hi.
It's great to see you again, Len.
Now, after writing novels about the destruction of the environment, land developers, telemarketers, corrupt politicians, and the lobbyists that love them, how did celebrity culture wind up in your crosshairs?
Well, I mean, what I write satire, and you sort of have to – the target sort of settles in after a while, especially – you know, I'm a news junkie, and I watch a lot of news, and I read a lot of newspapers, and the sheer volume of information about people I didn't care about was astonishing. Mm-hmm. And it seemed like the less significant they were, the more I learned about them. And you couldn't escape it. I mean – you would see a scroll on a, whether it was CNN or Fox, whatever you were watching, you would see a scroll that would say one line, you know, five American troops died in Afghanistan today. And like if you turn on paper today, latest Mel Gibson tape shows him, and it goes on and on. And you know more about Mel Gibson's vocabulary than you know about the surge in Afghanistan.
Actually, I'm always surprised that there's all this talk about somebody whose name I've never heard. I know who Mel Gibson is, but I'll see page six and they'll say her latest boyfriend is so-and-so.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know who she is and I don't know who the boyfriend is, but maybe that's my fault. In the light of the oil spill in the Gulf, did you jump the gun on environmental disaster?
Well, I've been writing, many of us in Florida have been writing about and against offshore drilling for a long time. There was a point when even Jeb Bush was leading the charge against it when he was governor. This renewed drill baby drill talk that caught on and actually turned some politicians completely the other direction. It's nothing new. It's one of those things where it is truly a worst case scenario, and it isn't something you ever want to say, I told you so. But we had been told and assured for two decades this could never, ever happen. And the scope would never be anything like the Valdez. And it turns out the Valdez is like a drop compared to what the Deepwater Horizon is. So in all those respects, you know, just from a news point of view, from a journalism point of view, it's not like we didn't see it coming. But from a novelist point of view, it's one of those scenarios in which you could have imagined and put into a novel, but it would have been trumped and surpassed and dwarfed by what really, really happened here.
Yeah, you couldn't have invented Tony Hayward saying some of those things.
Tony Hayward, yeah, I said in a column, you know, in the early weeks, he reminded me of that guy in the great Monty Python sketch, the pet shop owner,
right,
who the guy brings a dead parrot in, and the owner keeps telling that the parrot's not dead; it's just sleeping. It's just taking a nap, and that's who he was. The guy telling us, no, it's not so bad. He was like the guy in the Monty Python sketch.
You said earlier that much of what you write about comes from your clip file of crazy news stories. Did a specific incident in pop culture get you thinking about writing this book?
For a long time ago, actually. You know, the first instant I think that I knew that we were in deep trouble, and I'm talking about we, the media, the people who are supposed to be covering what ostensibly is news, journalism, was the O.J. Simpson trial. This is going back quite a few years, but I remember being horrified at the sight of all those satellite trucks from all those little TV stations in America that felt they had to send their own crews to Los Angeles to sit in a parking lot and get a feed out of the courtroom. Their reporters weren't even inside the courtroom. Not a shred of new information was produced that way. But all these clowns sat around with their dishes and their neckties giving the same report every night. And all I could think about was somewhere back home, a story is not being covered that's important to the people of that community, because these guys are out here sitting in the parking lot with this mob scene. Something was terribly wrong with that. They were covering a domestic homicide, which happens every day in our town, but not to famous football players. And then, then it became something that was in the back of my mind that I always wanted to write about, the not only just the public appetite, the diversionary, you know, sort of aspect of it, but the huge industry in particular, like the paparazzo who's in the novel. When I was doing Star Island, I mean, I had been fascinated with what possesses someone to go into that line of work.
There's a new documentary about Ron Galella.
And, I heard about, yeah.
You haven't seen it. I couldn't watch it after, by the way, kind of a positive look, but I stopped watching after they went into the way he stalked Jackie Onassis. It just made me uncomfortable.
Well, that's when I was younger, he was the guy, the paparazzo, and he was famous for one thing, harassing Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis. Now you have mobs and mobs of these people camping out, you know, in Sandra Bullock's backyard or in, you know, outside the Starbucks near Britney Spears' house. I mean, this is how they make a living. Can you imagine going home and trying to explain to your kids what you do for a living? You chase these poor folks around, some of whom really, truly don't have the talent to merit the attention that they're getting, or their gift to civilization is not commensurate with the amount of ink and TV time we're spending on them.
Well, in the past, it was mostly L.A. and New York.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Has it shifted to South Florida?
It follows them everywhere. We have – here was the worst part of Star Island for me was the research because I had to familiarize myself by reading all the tabs and all the magazines and watching all these shows on television. Who is important? Who is the celebrity of the du jour? What is the train wreck of the day? And I'm introduced to these people that I'd never heard of. The Kardashian sisters are a good example. I had no clue. They are from South Florida. I thought they were like a lounge act on Sunny Isles, you know. I'd never heard of them before. I still don't know what they do or what talent they may or may not have. But if you read the celebrity columns in South Florida, which are also – even whether you read Page Six up here, they're everywhere. They're ubiquitous. And so I had to learn all this stuff so that the novel would ring authentic with those people who do follow these kind of folks.
Well, Miami has become one of the centers. Does everyone want to become a star there in South Beach? People who look like they might dress quite conservatively back home wear some of the most outrageous and revealing outfits I've ever seen on a city street.
Oh, yeah. No, it's all about being seen. That's why it was such a good place to set this novel, because it really – and I've said that it's sort of the epicenter of pretension. It's a place where you go to display yourself, for better or for worse, and almost nothing of consequence ever happens there. That's what part of the place that makes it such a glorious attraction for, you know, if you want to, let's go clubbing on South Beach. I mean, you know.
And you have a club here called Pubes, and you know, I saw that and I thought, well, that's possible in South Beach.
Oh, it's very possible. I have another one called Abscess, I think. And these clubs come and go, Lenny. They're fleeting. You know, they're one space, one, another space, another time, another. And this is, it's funny because this is a recent development, because I remember years ago when South Beach was first becoming what it is now. It was just an old retirement, really, a community for retired folks, mainly from the New York area, from Brooklyn. And all that property was bought up, and once it was becoming gentrified, I remember the big controversy when Ronnie Woods of the Rolling Stones opened a nightclub on South Beach, and the neighbors all complained because the music was so loud and it was on so late, and just gave him a ration of grief about it. And now you've got clubs, and the police blotter on Sunday morning in Miami is quite interesting because of all the South Beach police calls. You could literally do a novel from them.
My guest is Carl Hiaasen, author of 12 novels, most of them bestsellers, and also 3 best-selling children's books, and he writes a weekly column for the Miami Herald. His latest novel is Star Island, and in Star Island, Cherry Pie, the 22-year-old fading star, is desperate for a comeback after a series of professional failures and personal screw-ups.
Yeah.
Now, I can't imagine that this would be based on any real person.
But
what are her accomplishments? Does she have any talent?
No, she's a child. She was a child, quote, star that was shoved into the limelight by her stage parents, and because of the technology we have right now, you don't have to be able to carry a tune, and you can record best-selling albums. It happens quite frequently. Someone who goes into the studio, that they have soundboards that not only adjust the pitch and make sure you never sing a note out of tune, they give you voices that you don't have, obviously background singers. I've said this, I could put my Labrador in a good sound studio with a good soundboard, and they make him sound like Pavarotti. And so you don't need much, except what they're selling is looks. They're selling an attractive young woman, and I don't think. Let me just suggest that the Britney Spears live album, when it doesn't go through a soundboard, is not going to be something people are going to be lining up to get.
So was Britney Spears an inspiration?
Inspiration. I mean, all.
Well, Sherry has problems with drugs, alcohol, sex. Her mother says it's all stomach problems.
I know, it's all stomach. Every time she crashes on overdoses, her mom says it's a stomach problem. Look, there's a parade of these people. The Hollywood mug shots, whether it's Paris Hilton, Britney, Nicole, you name it. Lindsay Lohan right now, as we're sitting here speaking, is the latest one who's sitting in a slammer pining away for her cigarettes and her makeup. There's an element of sadness to it, but there's also an element, if you do write sad, it is a statement on our culture that this Lindsay Lohan was the lead story on some of the L.A. local TV stations for several days running. What they're telling you is that nothing more important is happening in this city or in this country than the travails of this poor delaminated soul. As someone who writes satire, you have to. These are themes that you cannot ignore if you're trying to stay current, trying to stay topical, trying to write about what's happening in this country. As we hear about this great angry, divided country of ours. You have people on websites, millions apparently, clicking on, to hear Mel Gibson rant or to see Lindsay's clip from when the judge is, and you look at what she's written on her fingernails. All this is the stuff of national, it's getting national coverage. It's quite insane.
The heroine of the novel would have to be Anne DeLuisa, Cherry's double, when she's not feeling well but still needs to make a public appearance. Is there a precedent for anything like
no,
that?
No, but I think that someone will steal this idea.
Britney Spears might get somebody who actually remembers to put on her underwear.
Yes, I don't think it's far-fetched to suggest that because of what's at stake, the kind of dollars that are at stake in that world, that they would hire a lookalike, an actress in this case. Anne DeLuisa, who's my favorite character in the book, who's very hip to everything that's going on. And they have to trot her out whenever Cherry is too indisposed. And they just send her on these fleeting – she's out there really as a decoy for the paparazzi who have not figured it out yet. And she's a good actress. But this is not a job you would aspire to. But she's funny. I liked her character a lot. But I don't think it's too far-fetched to suggest that they would go to those lengths to protect a career, an upcoming concert tour, a new CD coming out. There's a lot happening in Sherry's life in the novel that everything has to be right. They can't afford another meltdown or another rehab. She's on, I don't know, remember her fifth rehab or something. And all these are calculated, and I don't doubt I know for a fact that there's PR people who, when they're trying to cobble back together someone's career, the first thing they say is, well, you got to go to rehab. And here's where you got to go. And you got to be seen going into rehab.
Well, Anne DeLuisa must be a pretty good double because she keeps on fooling the paparazzo bang Abbott, who even kidnaps her at one point.
Yeah, he goes around the bend. His big moment of failure in his career as a paparazzo was that he was on the other side of the country when Michael Jackson expired. And he had been waiting for that day for so long and had bribed various even bribing 911 operators that he knew that if they got heard anything about it, they would call him first so he could be first at the mansion. And he was nowhere to be seen, so he missed this huge opportunity. And Bang is convinced that Cherry is going to be the next big star to die. And he doesn't – and this takes him into a
– He wants to be around.
Fitful. He just wants to be around. He becomes obsessed with her.
You bring back some characters from previous novels,
yes,
including your former governor of Florida who pulled a Sarah Palin by quitting a midterm, or she pulled a skink.
Yeah.
There's also the disfigured ex-con. What is it
Chemo.
About?
Chemo, now he's only in one other novel, Skin Tight, but he's been gone for 17 years, so it was time to bring him back.
Is Florida, is politics in Florida stranger than some other places? This year seems to be the year of weird politics. How does Florida compare with what's happening in states like South Carolina, Nevada, Kentucky?
That's what's worrying me, is because I used to think we were just light years ahead in terms of the sleaze factor and the mutant factor. And I thought our politicians were, you know, in general, more corrupt and stupider about the corruption. But you have now these great scandals in these other places. South Carolina seems to produce, you know, more troglodytes in public office than Florida per capita. And Arizona is a close second, I would say. They're coming out of the woodwork. Utah's got some real, you know, real psychopaths in the mix out there.
Nevada, we have the chicken candidate.
Yeah. And well, here on New York, you've got the wife of a wrestling.
Connecticut.
Please. But right here in the New York market, media market is what I'm saying.
Yeah, we are seeing the ads on television.
Yeah, and Vince McMahon's wife. And I mean, eminently qualified.
And Rand Paul in Kentucky is calling for the end of all government.
Yeah, I mean, that's a guy who – actually, it's good to have these guys on the stage. But your point, and one that I would agree with, is that how would you invent anything more bizarre in fiction, in writing satire, than what's really out there on the real-life stage? And that's the challenge. It's hard to cook up anybody more bent or twisted than the real-life characters.
Well, the Charlie Crist story.
Yeah, Charlie. He's
a Republican who was going to be drummed out of the Republican Party because of rumors he was gay, and then he lost the primary.
No, the primary never happened.
Oh.
He bailed before
the
primary.
He just got pushed out because
he made
didn't
this decision that
he,
you know, Charlie was never – he was way too moderate for what has happened to the Republican Party, the hijacking of the Republican Party in Florida. So what he realized was if he skipped the primary and became an independent and saved all that money he raised and ran as a third-party candidate, he'd have a better chance of winning than he would as a Republican. And it's turned out he's now leading in the polls, and that the oil spill has certainly helped because he gets to show up on these beaches as governor. He's on TV all the time. He's been all over BP and got a bunch of money given to some of the Gulf Coast communities. And meanwhile, Marco Rubio, Mr. Tea Party darling, is who, by the way, is a drill baby drill guy. He's been oddly silent on that issue since April 20th. So it's changed the whole dynamic. And for columnists, for journalists in particular, it's much more fun to watch Charlie do his thing, because he was so bad at being conservative. You know, he had to change his position on almost everything from gay adoptions to abortion to gun rights to all these things. And he just didn't do it very convincingly.
You've written some pretty funny pieces about how BP and the government have been handling the spill, including one about the recruitment of a 12-year-old from Oklahoma to replace the top engineer of safety design for BP.
Well, at this point, they were early on the game. They were bringing in – when you turn on the TV and they're seriously sitting down with Kevin Costner to discuss cleaning up the biggest oil spill in the history of the planet, and they're asking Kevin Costner to.
Well, he has the boat.
He has the boat. He had the stuff. But that's how unprepared that company was. So it was hard not to go after him.
Someone suggested that BP might improve its PR effort if it hired Helen Thomas to deal with the press.
It couldn't be any worse.
You, in your column, you write also about Medicare scams, corrupt public servants, and the upcoming election. Do you think we'll be seeing a lot of Tea Partiers in the next Congress?
Oh, I think you'll see some. I think they've got a problem. I think the problem is that among all those who are there to complain about the deficit and big government and everything else, so you do also have an element that's a fairly unseemly element that they have to really get the concept of being a home for the racists out of their agenda. I mean, they've got to make an effort to get rid of those people, and because they're bloggers, they're on the blog, and this is where they've gravitated. And if the Tea Party is going to have any national success, they've got to disassociate themselves from those lunatics.
So let me make a prediction. Your next novel will be about someone who looks very much like Andrew Breitbart.
You know, I think this is the great thing about where we are right now in the world of communications, that it takes zero credentials to – I mean, anybody can start a blog, and you could literally I think with enough training, an orangutan could start a blog that would have a huge following.
Do you read a lot of blogs?
No, I don't. I don't. I mean, I read some. Some I don't. Who has the time? Anybody whose life is diminished to the point where you can sit for hours and hours and read that stuff has other problems going on in their world. I think, first of all, there's no fact-checking that goes on in many, many of these sites. And people are discovering that they're not as accurate as they might or should be. And I think that it's all fleeting. It's all, you know, I think it's fad. And I think that if, in fact, and I'm going to just say that if they were as powerful and far-reaching as we're being told and being warned, Obama would have never been elected president, ever.
Among Carl Hyacin's best-selling novels, Nature Girl, Skinny Dip, Sick Puppy, Lucky You, there have been three best-selling children's books, Hoot, Flush, and Scat, and his most recent work of nonfiction is The Downhill Lie, A Hacker's Return to a Ruinous Sport. He also writes a weekly column for the Miami Herald, and his latest novel is Star Island. It's published by Knopf. Thank you so much for being with us again.
It's good to see you again.